We are short of a quorum right now. We're hoping someone else shows up. Well, I must have got Tammy's mic.
No, I can turn it down. You can put it closer.
Okay. So we're hopeful that we get one more member here before we have to do any votes. My name is Braden Richmond. I'm the chair for the Southern Rack, and I represent the Sportsmen. I'm going to ask everyone on the council to introduce themselves tonight. We'll start with you, Austin. I think you're the only one that wasn't here last time, and then we'll just have everyone introduce and who you represent.
My name is Austin Atkinson. I live in Enoch, Utah, which is just north of Cedar City, representing public at large. This is my first meeting that I've made it to. I did make it to the training, but missed the August meeting. So excited to be here, excited to be a part of this.
Nick Jorgensen, represent the non-consumptives out of St. George, Utah.
I'm Craig Laube from Burl in Iron County, and I represent agriculture.
Gene Boardman, Hinckley, Utah, representing the public at large.
Sean Stewart, I work at Escalante, and I'm representing the BLM.
Did you want me to end it?
Yeah.
Kevin Bunnell, I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife.
Okay, I got this new list of what we're supposed to start these meetings with, and it's really long, but I think there's a couple things on here that are good to do. Actually, before I do that, I do want to recognize, man, that thing is humming. Is that better? Aren't you?
Yeah,
it's humming pretty good. No, it's the mic. Yeah, it's when I'm talking. Now it sounds
better.
All right. Can you hear me on that one? We do want to recognize Donnie Hunter here with the Wildlife Board. I think you're the only one here tonight, right? Okay. Appreciate you being here, and thank you for coming. Let me read this section right here. I think it's written really well. Maybe I'll try to paraphrase it in the future, but tonight I'm going to read it. It says, the purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management policy, rules, and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five regional advisory councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. And then just a reminder that we want to be respectful of other people's opinions. And then also a reminder that the meeting is recorded. So when you have comments or questions, just make sure to come and speak into the mic and state your name and speak loudly and clearly. So with that, let's go ahead and go into the agenda here. First item is, and this is a little different than in the past, so what we're going to do on the minutes is we're going to ask if anyone has any objections. If there's no objections, we're just going to move on. We don't need to take a vote on this. So this is a little different historically. Are there any objections to the minutes from last meeting? Okay. It appears that we have no objections. Any objections to the agenda? Okay. So let me turn it over to you, Kevin, for a regional update.
All right. Thank you. First, did you get my text? Would you try to find a number for Bart and give him and see if you can give him a call and find out if he's on his way? And we're checking with Verlin as well. We need to have one of them. You've sent one to Verlin. Okay. First of all, welcome to Austin. Glad you're able to join us. And I hope you enjoy serving on the RAC. I think we've got good representation here on the Southern Regional Advisory Council. As far as a regional update, our aquatic section has been totally distracted for the last month because Richard had a bull tag on the Boulder Mountain. I'm happy to report that he harvested his bull on Sunday, and so our aquatic section is up and operating again. Anything you'd like to add to that, Richard?
Like you said, I know nothing else about it.
How long did you wait? How many points? 15 points to draw an archery tag, and he enjoyed his hunt, and rightly so. Within our wildlife section, we have a kind of a concerning issue going on. It was up on the Oak Creek Mountains. There was a domestic goat that was in and amongst the bighorn sheep up there. We don't know where the goat came from. We don't know if it was a pack goat that got away from somebody or a backyard goat. We worked through with the county sheriff. That goat has been removed, and it is we're getting disease testing done now. Hopefully those come back clean. If not, we'll have fingers crossed to hopefully don't have an issue with the bighorn sheep on the Oak Creek Mountains. Our habitat section, the biggest thing going on right now is kind of keeping track of all the fires. We had a really slow fire year until last week. We now have four active fires in the region. We have what's called the Neck Fire that's north of Enoch, between Enoch and Minersville. That's sitting at about 19,000 acres. I think is mostly contained at this point, the word that we're getting from the BLM, and we will be working on getting a rehab plan put together for that. There's also a fire south of Meadow. Dave, do you know how many acres that is?
The last I checked, it's 4,100 acres, just over 4,100.
So just over 4,000 acres. That one's got into some steep, rocky country that's difficult to fight. There was a small one south of Oak Creek. I don't think that one went anywhere. I think it was stayed to under 100 acres. And then there's one that's north of Scipio that's actually in the central region, but we've been coordinating on that one a little bit as well. Within our law enforcement section, so when fires hit, our law enforcement section is called out on security duty to secure the roads around the fires, and so a lot of our regional conservation officers have been involved with that. Prior to that going there, we have had several poaching cases in the region. And you probably saw the news coverage of that there were, I think, three individuals that were arrested for killing a trophy buck out on the Vandenberg Road there just south of Cedar City, so southwest of Cedar City. We also have successfully or issued a citation to someone that killed a doe on the Beaver Mountain, which is fine, except for they had a tag for the Stansbury Mountains. So that's where it becomes an issue, and that citation has been issued as well. Paul, anything you'd like to add to that?
It was just too far of a drive to go from the Beaver Mountain where they wanted to camp to the Stansbury.
Okay, so I guess a tag's a tag to some people. Within our law enforcement, they're also wrapping up a very busy AIS season. We inspected more boats and decontaminated more boats than ever. I assume that's a trend that will continue into the future as that becomes more and more of an issue. We are exploring new ways to kind of contain that threat at Lake Powell. It may involve us moving off of the ramps and putting more permanent check stations on the nice thing about Lake Powell is it is somewhat isolated. There's only a certain number of roads that you can take. Everybody has to take one of the three or four roads to get to Lake Powell, and so we may change the strategy, but that will depend on some funding coming from the legislature and some other things that have to get in place there. Within our outreach section, there's a kokanee viewing event on September 21st up at Fish Lake. There's a brand new boardwalk that's been built up there that should make that a really nice event, along with the other construction that's going on up at Fish Lake to improve the marinas. The boardwalk that was there along, what's the name of the creek, Richard? Twin Creeks. I don't know that it's all the way done, but it's done enough that we can have a good viewing event for the kokanee. And then lastly, with from our front desk staff, you remember at the last meeting, I made you aware that our any bowl tags sold out in 11 days. As of about, I don't know what time I asked Mindy, but about 2 o'clock, we had just over 1,000 spike tags left of the 15,000 that were there. So if you haven't bought an elk tag and want to hunt, I would suggest you do it sooner rather than later. And Mr. Chairman, that's all I have, unless there's questions.
Any questions? I messed up already. This is my second time as chair, so I get a few mulligans, but I skipped over the Wildlife Board meeting update, and as I'm looking at that, I printed off a whole bunch of things, but I didn't print off my notes for that. So I may have to wing it a little bit with your help. So this last Wildlife Board, we covered the bobcat harvest recommendations, and that passed as presented. In fact, there was very little comment on that. The cougar recommendations, generally there was a feeling of giving a few more cougar tags in the state. I don't remember the motions on that. I know the Stansberries, they upped the tags on the Stansberries, and one other area.
I think there was on the southwest Manti was increased as well.
So just those two. So Stanberry and Southwest Manti, they increased above the division's recommendations, and then I think everything else was accepted as presented, if I recall correctly. The expo permit audit, good report, and positive. I don't think there was a vote on that. Oh, yeah, there was, so it was accepted. Expo permit allocation, same thing, good presentation and accepted. And then they went into a Wildlife Board appeal. If you're interested in that, it's all on the Internet. I think that's everything. Is there anything else I need to cover there that you're aware of?
No, I would just say I was not there either. I was traveling with my family, but watched some of it afterwards. And the board meeting went quite smoothly. The appeal lasted 7 hours. It was a long day for the board members, right, Donnie? Which I think is a good thing that our board members take those appeals seriously when someone's been involved in a violation. So that's to their credit that they took the time to make the right decision.
You know, if it's all right, I'd like to add one additional comment to that. It was 7 hours, but I've heard quite a few people that watch that, and I think there's some value in actually watching that and seeing some of the thought process and getting a better understanding of, you know, some of our obligations and some of the things that we need to be aware of. So it was educational for me. Any other questions, comments there? All right. Well, let's start with our fishing informational from Craig Walker.
Actually, we have Randy Opplinger that is, he and Craig will be tag teaming this through the state, and we've got Randy tonight.
Yeah. Line 9. How do I start this, Phil? Perfect.
Takes a few seconds to show you the next slide.
Okay. Should be good. Okay, well, thanks again for the introduction. Like Kevin said, my name is Randy Opplinger, and I'm the Cold Water Sport Fish Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife Resources. And tonight I'm actually going to provide two informational presentations. The first one is about some work that we're trying to do in response to some feedback we got from last year's RAC and Wildlife Board Tour that we did with Aquatics, looking at tailoring our angler opportunities to meet our angler needs. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that as I go here today. But where I want to start is I want to talk a little about some background behind this and why this is so important to us. So first off, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but during our RAC and Wildlife Board Tour last year, we proposed the removal of special fly and lure only regulations on two waters here in the southern region. And the Wildlife Board did not approve those proposed removals due to some mismatch that was perceived between what the anglers desire and the regulations that we were offering across the landscape. Additionally, we received some feedback with some concerns over the removal of brook trout populations and brook trout fishing opportunities here in the state. And there was some desire expressed pressed for more bait fishing opportunities on rivers here in the state. So the aquatic section responded by agreeing to examine the angling experiences. So we're looking at gear restrictions, harvest limits, the species we offer, and the locations that we offer different species across the state, with the idea of comparing with angler preferences to make sure that what we're providing the anglers aligns with the anglers truly want. I'm going to get into this a little bit more, but as we're looking at this, the topic of crowding in our fisheries also becomes important. This will become kind of apparent as I go through this presentation. But one thing we know is Utah is one of the fastest growing states here in the country, and it's forecasted that our population is going to grow from 3.2 million people that we have currently to about 5.5 million people by the year 2050. And what we're seeing overall is a pretty stable participation rate in the sport of fishing here in the state. And I'm kind of showing that in a graph over there where I'm showing time across that horizontal axis. And that kind of red line is showing our participation rate in anglers. Looks like it's declining a little, but that decline is very slight. But when you combine that angling participation rate with the fact that our population is growing, what we're projecting is about a 7% increase in the number of anglers in Utah by 2025, a 26% increase by 2040, and a 39% increase by 2050. And one thing that we know is the perception of crowding is one of the main reasons why people cease participating in the sport of fishing. So to us, the idea of keeping anglers satisfied is really critical. It's something that we strive to do. And what we're looking at doing is beginning to tailor our managed fishing experiences to meet the needs of anglers proportionately to our angling public, starting with our 2021 regulation cycle. So what I mean is, for example, let's suppose that 20% of anglers prefer to fish for largemouth bass at lakes and reservoirs. Then our goal would be to have 20% of our lakes or reservoirs be managed for largemouth bass. And one thing in doing that, we also want to ensure that the unique ways that anglers participate in the sport of fishing don't conflict with one another. And one model that we've talked about is from the Forest Service, where often there's some crowding issues on hiking trails. And what the Forest Service has done is they've often created multiple trails. So they might have a horseback trail, a motorized vehicle trail, and a hiking trail that all end up in roughly the same spot. But the idea is you have different users using different trails, but they all kind of go to the same place, but it spreads people out and reduces this perception of crowding. So what we think is there's some opportunities with how we manage our fisheries to help spread people out to some extent by providing multiple opportunities in the water. So we might provide good shore angling opportunities and boat angling opportunities, because boat anglers and shore anglers don't interact that much because they're using different territory when they fish. So that's something sort of in the back of our mind as we're moving forward with this. So now I just want to kind of get into the nuts and bolts of how we want to go about this. So really, the first step in our process is we want to assess our angler preferences and the behaviors of the angling public. Fortunately, right now, we're sitting on the results of a survey that were conducted in 2017. It's a survey we do every 5 years, and what it is an attitudinal survey, which helps us get kind of a pulse on the angling public and the attitudes of the angling public here in the state. This is a study that we do in collaboration with Utah State University, so it's a very scientifically driven study, and the last iteration of it we did in 2017. And what we did is we surveyed 10,000 anglers via email in proportion to their representation among all licensed anglers. So we took in consideration license type and gender when we came up with a pool of people that we would randomly send this survey out to. So what we propose doing is using the behavior preference results to define preference groups among Utah anglers who see common experiences. For example, anglers who fish for similar species in similar settings using similar gear. And I'll kind of get into this a little bit more detail here later in the presentation. And we also want to identify where those angler preference groups are willing to go to fish. So we're looking at their willingness to travel. So are they willing to go 2 hours, 3 hours, 6 hours? We don't know. We're looking at this using the data to find that preferred fishing opportunity for them. So that's the first step in this process. The first step is to assess what our anglers actually want, so what their behaviors and their preferences are. The next step in this process is to identify the experiences that we currently offer in the over the landscape. So it's sort of an inventory of what we have. And then after that is a capacity assessment. The idea behind this capacity assessment is that we can identify the variety of experiences that a water isn't currently providing but could provide if we manage that water a little bit differently. So when we do this capacity assessment, there's really a lot of things that we can take into consideration, a lot of questions we can ask. I'm throwing some examples up here. This isn't an exhaustive list, but it gives you an idea of things we can consider. So, for example, does a water that's currently managed for trout have the capacity to be managed for bass or wiper or kokanee salmon? Could current regulations be modified at a water allow for greater harvest? Could the regulations be modified to create a gear-specific, like a fly-only fishing experience at a water? Could infrastructure improvements be made to increase accessibility for shoreline anglers? Or can habitat be manipulated to create a new fishing experience at this water? Or we can consider whether smaller fish could be stocked at higher densities to increase angler catch rates at a water that's currently managed for trophy fish. So again, that's not an exhaustive list, but that's a list of things we might consider among other things when we're looking at the other opportunities that we could provide at a particular water. And then the last step in this process is really a gap assessment. What gaps are is they're the mismatches between what the anglers prefer and what we're providing anglers right now. So we want to identify where there are gaps between the preferred fishing experiences and the experiences we currently offer. And we want to determine how we can use that capacity that I just talked about as a vehicle to help fill some of those gaps to make sure we're providing anglers the opportunities that they're truly seeking. And of course, in the process, there's probably going to be some gaps that we can't address based on biology of fish and the waters that we have here, and we'll have to acknowledge that as part of this process. And then again, willingness to travel is an important attribute to this. Again, willingness to travel is basically the distance an angler is willing to travel to experience their preferred fishing experience. And we want to look at where anglers' preferred fishing experiences reside and determine whether the opportunities they're seeking are available within a radius or a distance that they're willing to travel. Okay, so that's really kind of a broad overview of what we're looking at. And we've kind of started down this path already, so I'm going to provide some examples of some results that we received to date with some of these analyses that we started performing. So what we've been looking at is we've been looking at angler preferences and behaviors using the results of that survey. So to date, we've looked at the preferred species of anglers, preferred water type, gear preferences, and preferred water access method. So those are four preference things that we've looked at. And one behavioral thing that we've been looking at is the time that anglers actually spend pursuing a species. So first off, I'm going to look at what we found so far, looking at species preference. What we've done is a pretty complicated multivariate statistical analysis that allows us to evaluate the strength of the relationship between the species preferences and allows us to group anglers into various species preference groups. So when we did this, we came up with five different species preference groups. So we found that 10% of our anglers identify themselves as lake salmonid anglers. So these are anglers who are pursuing basically trout species that are specialized for lakes, like lake trout, kokanee salmon, splake, and in some cases, some of our large reservoir cutthroat trout populations. Next off, 4% of our anglers identified themselves as warm water fish anglers, and then 8% of our anglers identified themselves as bass and walleye anglers. Now, bass and walleye are technically a warm water fish species, but when we did the analysis, we found significant differences between the bass walleye anglers and basically the rest of the warm water fishes. So when I talk about warm water fishes, I'm talking about panfish, catfish, I'm talking about yellow perch, and I'm talking about tiger muskie and northern pike. So it's basically all your warm water fishes except for bass and walleye, which are a standalone group. Next off, we found that 68% of our anglers preferred fishing for stream salmonid species. So these are stream trouts like brown trout and brook trout, for example. And then finally, 10% of our anglers identified as what we call generalists. And so these generalists are basically anglers that don't prefer any one species group. And instead, they seem to pursue a lot of different species. They don't fall neatly into any of these categories. So one interesting thing that came out of the species preference information, I'm going to get into this a little bit more detail later, but we found that non-resident anglers who prefer to fish for warm water fish species seem to really like targeting crappie. So I'm showing in a graph over there the number of non-resident anglers that responded to our survey who identified themselves as warm water fish anglers, and I'm showing different species across the bottom. So we have bluegill, channel catfish, crappie, northern pike, tiger muskie, white bass, wiper, and yellow perch. And what we found is basically twice as many anglers or non-resident anglers preferred fishing for crappie over any other warm water fish species that we had in that group. The next thing we looked at is preferred fishing method and fishing setting. We did the same analysis and we came up with three different groups of anglers. So we found that 8% of our anglers prefer fishing lakes by boats, 18% prefer fishing lakes along the shoreline, and then finally 74% of our anglers prefer wading when they go fishing. And then looking at gear preference, we found 22% of our anglers identify themselves as lure anglers, 28% identify themselves as fly anglers, 46% identify themselves as bait anglers, and the remaining 4% we put in this category we call other, and these are anglers that really fish with some kind of mixture of lures, flies, and bait with pretty high proportions of all of them. So they seem to have no clear preference. They like using a little bit of everything when they go out and fish. So one really nice thing that we're able to do with these analyses is we're able to start superimposing some of these preferences on top of each other so we can start building kind of a profile of what our anglers look like here in the state. So I'm showing one such example of this in this graph right here. I'll kind of walk you through this graph. But if you look on the left side of the graph, you typically have anglers who are more associated with being lake anglers, and their stream preference increases as you move right. And toward the bottom, you have anglers who don't invest a lot in their fishing gear. So we frequently have bait anglers down at the bottom end of this graph who are investing in maybe a rod, a bobber, hook, and some worms. And then if you move up, you have your lure anglers who not just have their terminal tackle and their fishing rod, but they frequently have boats and trolling motors and outriggers and a lot of other equipment. So they're investing a lot in the equipment. If we start kind of on the bottom left part of this graph, what we find are bait anglers are typically our generalists in terms of the species they target, so they're targeting a little bit of everything, and they're also our warm water anglers. If we move off to the right, we find that our fly anglers are our stream salmonid anglers, and then if we move up to the top left, we find that our lure anglers are typically targeting lake salmonids or bass and walleye. Now, this is another similar graph. In this case, again, the stream orientation increases, so the preference for fishing along on a stream increases as you move right. And as you move up in this graph, mobility of the angler increases, where you have bait anglers toward the bottom who are typically fishing from like a chair along the shoreline. So they're basically letting the fish come to their bait. And toward the top, you have lure anglers who are fishing from a boat who are often out there, and they're trolling, and they're actively hunting basically the fish that they're looking for. So the associations we found are that our bait anglers are typically fishing lakes along the shoreline, our fly anglers are typically wading, and then our lure anglers are fishing lakes by the boat. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we also have some behavior data that we looked at. And what we looked at is the days that anglers spend fishing in Utah and other states, and we compared that between non-resident anglers, which is the right graph, and resident anglers, which is the graph on the left. What we have in this graph are the different species groups. So we have bass, walleye, lake salmonids, other. In this case, that's the same thing as generalists, stream salmonids, and our warm water anglers. And kind of the cream or tan colored bars are days they spend fishing in Utah, and the orange color bars are the days they spend fishing in other states. And there's really kind of three take-home messages that I want to get out of this. The first one is if we look at our resident anglers, so that's the left graph, what we find is they really seem to like fishing here in Utah. And that tells us that we're providing a good experience for our resident anglers, and they're really appreciating what we have, and they're not having to go to other states to seek the experiences they're looking for. Now, that differs a little bit when we look at the non-resident anglers. So one thing that sticks out there is if we look at our warm water anglers, what we find is they spend disproportionately more time fishing in Utah for warm water fish species than they spend fishing in other states. So that tells us that we're providing a good warm water fishing experience. It's really drawing some of these non-resident anglers here into Utah. Now, in contrast, if we look at bass walleye, what we find is they're spending disproportionately more time fishing in other states for bass and walleye, which indicates other states must have a better bass fishing experience than we have here in Utah. That's really drawing these anglers in. Okay, so that's kind of a broad overview of the results. Now I just kind of want to get into how we could start using some of these results to drive how we manage our fisheries here in the state. So one thing that we could look at are changes in regulations for different species here in the state. And there's really a lot of things that we can look at. I'm just going to bring up one example, and that one kind of sticks out to us as crappie regulations. So we know that non-resident anglers seem to seek warm water fishing experiences more in Utah than they do in other states. And we know those non-resident warm water anglers seem to prefer fishing for crappie. So that tells us that perhaps liberalizing crappie regulations in some of our waters could encourage greater non-resident angler use here in the state. Now, another thing that we could look at is how we, or changes in how we manage species broadly here in the state. And again, there's a lot of things that we could look at, but one that kind of sticks out are our statewide largemouth bass and walleye management, where we're seeing that non-resident anglers seem to seek bass and walleye fishing experiences in other states more than they seem to do so in Utah. So that means it's probably time for us to do a bit of a gut check in terms of our management of bass and walleye here in Utah to see if there's maybe some things that other states are doing that we can adopt here in Utah that might improve these fisheries. So obviously the improvement of the management of largemouth bass and or walleye fisheries might help attract more non-resident anglers here in the state, and of course has a side benefit for our resident anglers as well, who would benefit if there are some improvements made to the management of these species. Another thing that we could look at are changes in how we manage access and amenities here in the state. And one thing that sticks out to us is our shoreline angler access. So one thing we know is that anglers who prefer fishing for warm water species are more likely to fish from shore using bait. And our preliminary analyses indicate these anglers are more likely to keep fish for food, and they prefer fishing at locations that have good amenities like restrooms and fish cleaning stations. Now, one thing that we acknowledge is that there's a lack of developed shoreline angling access sites at our warm water fisheries here in the state. And in fact, outside our community fisheries, there are no fish cleaning stations tailored to the needs of our shoreline anglers anywhere here in the state. So we have fish cleaning stations, but we often put them on boat ramps, which are very convenient for boat anglers, but they're not necessarily located in the best spots for our shoreline anglers. So what we could begin doing is improve our shoreline angling opportunities and look at things like trails and fish cleaning stations to try to improve access for these anglers. And we think that this will help address some of the needs of an underserved portion of our angling public. Okay, then finally, I just want to talk about where we plan on going from here. So we're really in the early steps of this process. We definitely need to continue to evaluate the survey data to learn more about the preferences of our anglers and to do a better job of grouping our anglers as well. We also still need to look at that willingness to travel component. Again, that's to determine how far anglers are willing to drive for their preferred fishing experience, because we want to replicate that experience enough on the landscape that it's always within a bubble or a radius that anglers are willing to drive. Next, we still need to do an inventory and a capacity assessment of our existing fisheries to see how they align with those angler preference groups, to see how well we're doing at providing those opportunities for our anglers. And then we need to modify the management of our fisheries where it's needed and feasible to meet the needs of our anglers. And then again, there's going to be some gaps, and we need to look at addressing those gaps by creating new angling opportunities here in the state. Now, on top of the attitudinal survey that I've talked about, we also have a lapsed angler survey that we haven't dove into yet. And a lapsed angler is somebody who used to participate in the sport of fishing but doesn't fish currently. And we have results from that survey, and we want to begin looking at that to see if there's some results that we could tease from that survey that would provide us insight in how we could draw these lapsed anglers back into the sport of fishing. And then once we kind of done these things that I've talked about, so look at the survey results, so look at the preferences of our anglers, do an inventory of what we're providing, look at capacity and fill any gaps, what we propose doing is incrementally proposing some data-driven regulatory changes between 2021 and 2029 in two-year intervals to begin filling some of these gaps. Now, the reason that we'll start next year and do this in two-year intervals is that's when we do our fishing regulation changes on a two-year cycle. So next year would be the first time we would kind of have that opportunity to bring some regulation changes forward. We also propose to continue serving our anglers in five-year intervals in a manner that allows us to adapt to changing angler preferences and behaviors, changing habitat conditions, and increased demand. And then finally, we propose to continue to survey anglers after we make any kind of management or regulation changes to make sure that they're responding well to the changes that we're making. So that's really a broad overview of where we're going. You'll kind of see this unveiled really more as we present some regulation changes next year, but that gives you kind of a brief overview of what we're looking at right now and some of the early results that we've looked at. And I'd just like to thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take questions if anybody has any.
Thank you. So this was an informational, but I think we still want to open it up for questions and or comments. So we'll follow just, I think the best way to do this is just follow the normal process where the council, the RAC would ask questions first, then we'll turn it over to the public, and then comments from the public and comments from the RAC. But we will not be voting on this item. It's informational. So any questions from the RAC?
I'm here. Just out of curiosity, on the 10,000 people that were surveyed, was that respondents or was that what was sent out? And if how many responses did you actually get? You know that?
Yeah, we actually have 10,000 responses. That was kind of our target number. So we actually sent it out to more people. I'm not sure the total number that we sent it to, but that's the sample size we're working with.
Gotcha. Thank you.
You mentioned people's preferences in there. Did you survey their preferences, or how they actually fish?
It really is preference driven, actually. So a lot of the questions we kind of referred to were based on, if you were to go fishing for a day, for example, what species of fish would you prefer to catch? So we're not asking people to report on past trips or what they, you know, successfully have done. We're actually asking, if you could have any opportunity, what would you prefer to do?
Well, I'd prefer fishing big water from a boat, but what actually happens is a community pond with nightcrawler.
And I think we're able to tease some of that out. So we're able to kind of correct the results a little bit. So we're not necessarily, I mean, you're absolutely right. I think everybody would love to have a boat, but we're able to correct it to some extent based off of what people are actually doing.
Randy, can I ask a couple of questions?
Yeah,
that just seemed counterintuitive to me. Well, first, of the warm water, the results, how much of that's driven by Lake Powell?
I'm going to guess, we haven't looked too hard at this, probably a substantial portion though is driven by Lake Powell, would be our guess.
Okay. And then I was, and this is just based on conversations I've had with Richard, that the highest preference was for stream fishing for salmonids. And yet, at least in southern Utah, it seems like our streams are vastly underutilized. There is so much more opportunity there than people are taking advantage of. Is that largely being driven by the Green River and the Provo River and some of the larger streams in northern Utah?
It is largely statewide we're looking at here. So to kind of clarify, we did break this down by regions. And I'm not too familiar with those results off the top of my head, but the southern region was one where stream fishing was less popular than in other regions. So I think it's kind of an underutilized opportunity. But it is largely driven, that stream salmonid preference, by northern Utah, so central region, northern region, kind of the Salt Lake area.
Okay, thank you.
My question is kind of a follow-up question to Kevin's, actually, because I had the same thought, is how much of that's driven by Lake Powell? So, for example, you said the crappie was the highest sought after. But if Lake Powell's a destination, a vacation destination, and then they fish on their vacation, I wonder if we're skewing that.
I think there's no doubt. Unfortunately, we don't have enough information to know where people are actually fishing to drive some of that. We just know where people came from. So that does skew things a little bit. But when you look at the number of days people spend fishing for these species, it seems highly inflated, particularly for those warm water fishes. I don't think people spend as much time as maybe it says on there, which tells me, like you talked about, like Lake Powell, you don't go for an afternoon, you go for several days. And I think that's kind of driving up the numbers a little bit.
And Randy, I would add to that, and Richard, fill in here if you have anything to add, but, you know, Wayne's data seems to indicate that, yeah, I mean, a lot of the visitation at Lake Powell isn't driven by fishing, but there are people that come there specifically to fish. It is that's their reason for going there. And it's I don't think it's an insignificant reason for people going to Lake Powell. I mean, there are the people that go there to boat, but there are a lot of people that go there specifically to fish as well.
Any other questions from the rec? Any questions from the public? Any other comments from the rec? All right, thank you. Good presentation. Appreciate it. Just a note, we have heard from the other rec members, and we are not going to have a quorum tonight. We'll proceed as though we do, and we'll even take votes, but they will not be official. But at least we can have the count, so when we report to the board, we can tell them where we're at. So we'll proceed as though we do have a full quorum, but we acknowledge that we do not. So if we can go ahead with the next one, the private fishing ponds rule and amendments.
That's okay. So I'm actually going to give a second informational before I get onto that one. So I'm doing three presentations. It's not showing on there. It's just part of the fishing informational. So
all right. Doing I'm glad I'm not the only one that messed up the agenda tonight.
It's a little confusing. So the second one is a completely different topic. And what we're going to be talking about is basically some things we're looking at to simplify the issuance of certificates of registration for fishing tournaments here in the state. So before I get into that, I just want to talk a little bit about a certificate of registration. I'm going to call it a COR throughout my presentation. But a COR is a special permit that covers certain wildlife-related activities. So give you some examples in kind of the fisheries realm. We offer CORs for people to have game fish species in a pond that's on their private property, for example. And another one I'm going to really focus in on here today is fishing tournaments. So we, in a lot of cases, require a COR to be issued before a fishing tournament is held. Now, typically, people who want to participate in an activity that require any kind of COR apply for their permit using a paper application they download from the division webpage. So basically, they download it, fill it out by hand, and then either turn it in or mail it in to a division office. And then from there, those applications are reviewed by regional and Salt Lake division personnel, and they're approved or denied on a case-by-case basis. So one thing that's really come up is the public is pretty dissatisfied with what they view as being a flawed COR process. And on top of that, us as division personnel, we acknowledge that the review of CORs can often be very time-consuming. And there's very often a backlog of COR applications that's awaiting for approval. So what we want to do within the division is we want to create a more efficient process for the application and approval CORs. That's something that's going to benefit the public, and it's also going to benefit us within the division. And we're really looking at this at all CORs here in the state, but one of the low-hanging fruits that we're looking at is our fishing tournament COR. So I'm really going to kind of dive into that fishing tournament COR and talk about kind of what we're thinking for that particular COR. So what we're looking at is basically an automated fishing tournament COR application process that would be offered online. And the idea is that people would answer a suite of questions online, and the online system would provide guidance to those applicants regarding the eligibility of their request. And what the system would do is it basically would automatically just compare the responses against our current rule requirements. So we're looking at things like aquatic invasive species or AIS certification, number of participants, prize values, whether they're having a live weigh-in, the species they're fishing for, and whether or not certain fishing regulations are being adhered to are all things that are considered when a COR for a fishing tournament is reviewed, and we're proposing basically a system that would do that automatically to a large extent just to speed this process up. Now, when we look specifically at the fishing tournament COR, one of the big concerns that we have and one of the primary functions of this COR is to prevent scheduling conflicts where we have multiple tournaments happening at the same water at the same day. That creates conflicts among tournaments and also just drives a lot of people to a water, and that creates conflicts for anglers who aren't there for a fishing tournament. They're just there for the day, and there's a lot of other anglers there that day. So we're hoping that an online application would help address that conflict by not allowing tournaments to occur on any really popular fishing days, so holidays or free fishing days, or on locations or dates that are determined by the Division of Wildlife or other managers. A lot of these tournaments are on state park properties, so it might be determined by state parks, but to be dates where we just don't want to have a fishing tournament for whatever reason. And also on dates for dates at a particular water where a fishing tournament is already scheduled. So that's one function, is this scheduling function of this fishing tournament COR, just to make sure there's no date conflicts when the tournament's being proposed. And again, it would also provide guidance to the anglers to our rules and whether they're adhering to the rules with the COR that they're proposing. Okay, so what I want to do is I just want to walk you through kind of a mock-up of what we're thinking for this process. This isn't online yet. This is really kind of an early draft of what we're thinking the system's going to look like, but it'll give you kind of a good overview of the process that we're thinking about. So the idea is that anglers who want to hold a fishing tournament would go online and they would answer just a basic suite of questions. So the questions they would have to answer is whether the contestants are fishing from a boat, whether they're going to have a live weigh-in, whether they're going to need tagged fish for that tournament, the number of contestants are going to be participating, what the cash value of the prizes for the tournament is going to be, the tournament start date and end date, and the water body that tournament's going to be held on. And then after that, they're going to press basically the continue button to move forward. In this case today, the simulation has four continue buttons for four different simulations. That won't be on the final version, but that helps me through the presentation today. So we're going to get a mouse, Phil. Does it move around? Oh, maybe it's moving for me.
Yep.
I just need to get it on the screen.
What do you need to do?
I just need to click.
Oh, you need to be like over on this.
Yeah.
Can you not click over here?
It might be able to try.
Is that what you need?
Yeah, that's what I want. Ah, that works. Okay. I'll just do that. So the first example is what we're calling a date collision. A date collision just simply means there's two tournaments that are being proposed on a water on the same day. So in this case, in that initial questionnaire, people say they're going to be fishing from boats. They're not going to have a live weigh-in. There's going to be 120 contestants, $2,000 of prizes, and they're going to hold the tournament on July 6th and 7th of next year at Electric Lake. And then what it's going to tell you is this event needs authorization. That means it needs a COR. So it's done that check of our rules and it's found that it exceeds some limits where a COR is going to be needed. But then it's going to tell people that the dates of the chosen, in this case for Electric Lake, already have a tournament that's been reserved. So it's going to ask people basically to adjust their tournament dates to prevent that conflict. And then they're going to have an option of basically looking at a list of tournaments that are currently scheduled so they can select another date or water body for their tournament. So this list is going to show the water body name, the dates of tournaments that are scheduled, the organization that's organizing the tournament, and whether the tournament's involving tagged fish. The reason we're showing the organization is we think there's maybe some opportunities for organizations to work together to negotiate some date conflicts and help to alleviate those. But that's kind of the idea for the first part of it, is if there is a date collision, they'll have the idea opportunity to see what other dates are available or water bodies so they can change the date of their tournament. Okay, so the next example is going to be one that's going to require a COR. So in this case, the contestants are fishing from boats. They're not going to have a live weigh-in. There's going to be 120 contestants, $2,000 of prizes, and now they've changed their dates for their tournament. So they're proposing August 6th and 7th of next year at Electric Lake. In this case, there's no conflict of dates. There's no other tournaments being held at Electric Lake at that day, but still the tournament needs a COR. So what it's going to do is it's going to walk them through basically a system where they can get their COR issued from there. So the next page is going to ask for some more detailed information like contact information, the organization that's sponsoring the tournament, entry fees, whether it's going to allow pre-fishing, and the locations of any kind of weigh-in locations. So they fill that out. The next step in this is there's an aquatic invasive species certification. It's simply a form that they have to sign, but they'll be able to sign that electronically online. Next, there'll be a payment portal of some kind. The application for a COR costs $10. You'll be able to take the payment online, so they wouldn't have to mail a check in or anything like that. So it'd be part of the system. And then the last step is their COR would automatically appear. So the electronic system does it all for them in a matter of 10 minutes or so versus mailing in paper applications. And the idea is there'd be some copy of their COR that they could just print off right then and there, or they'd have an option of us just mailing them a COR if they would prefer that. So that's the second example. Okay, so the third one is going to be a tournament that does not require a COR. This one's pretty simple. In this case, the contestants are not fishing from boats. They're having a live weigh-in. There's going to be 49 contestants, $500 of prizes. It's going to be May 6th and 7th of next year at Deer Creek Reservoir. So when the system looks at what's entered, it compares it to the rule and decides that no COR is needed. And then basically it just tells them that. It says, you don't need authorization from us. Go ahead and just hold your tournament. Oops. Screw this up. Okay, and the last example is a tagged fish contest. So a tagged fish contest is where somebody checks the box for yes under our tag, or are you going to tag fish for this tournament? In this case, all tagged fish contests, there's going to only be one tagged fish contest per water per year, and also the tags have to be put in by Division of Wildlife representatives. So what it would all do is it bring basically people to a screen where they'd be able to contact their regional biologist to set up having those fish tagged and get that tournament set up from there. Okay, so that's really just a broad overview of this automated process that we're hoping to embark on for these fishing tournament CORs. We're hoping that activation of an actual functional portal will happen sometime in the beginning of the year 2021. As part of that, there's also going to be a monthly report that's going to be posted on the division webpage that shows all the tournaments that have been scheduled to date so people can see what tournaments are out there so that they know there's a tournament going on in their favorite water, or if they're planning a tournament, they know right from the get-go what dates to avoid. On top of that, we are more than likely next year going to propose some rule modifications to our fishing tournament rule. Historically, fishing tournament COR was designed to prevent over-harvest and mortality of stockfish, but we find no evidence that fishing tournaments are really having a biological impact here in the state. So we'll probably propose some rule changes that are going to modernize this fishing tournament COR a little bit and probably simplify it for the anglers. So that's what I have there, and again, I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions from the RAC? Any questions from the public? Just look right at you since there's one. Any comments? All right. Another one?
I got one more.
All right. You've got the right cadence going on, so keep going.
Yeah, like not breaking that.
This one's actually...
This is the proposed rule change.
So this is not informational. This is the action item.
This is the action item, yeah.
And you're presenting it, not Randy.
I'm Randy.
You are Randy. Sorry.
That's okay.
I was thinking the other guy. Okay, great.
So this is a proposed rule change. So what we're basically recommending is a modification to our private pond rule, which is R657-59, that would establish some circumstances where aquaponics facilities can operate without a certificate of registration. So before I kind of get into the nuts and bolts of this rule change, I just want to talk a little bit about the Private Aquaculture Advisory Council, or PAAC. I'm going to call it the PAC throughout my presentation. But what the PAC is, it's an advisory council that was established by the Utah legislature back in 2017. It's a 10-member advisory council that consists of private aquaculturists, private pond owners, anglers, representatives of the Division of Wildlife Resources, and representatives of the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. So one goal of the PAC is to give advice and recommendations to the Wildlife Board on rules adopted concerning the regulation of private fish ponds, private stocking, and short-term fishing events. And the PAC also advises on the aquatic animal species authorized for importation or use in aquaculture facilities, fee fishing facilities, private fish ponds, short-term fishing events, and private stocking. So one topic that came up at a recent PAC meeting was the topic of aquaponics. So aquaponics is something that's increasing in popularity, not just here in Utah, but really throughout the nation and even the world. And there's really the topic of aquaponics is not addressed under current Division of Wildlife Resources rules. So what we've traditionally done is we've handled aquaponics facilities like we would a private fish pond under a private pond rule, which is R657-59. In reality, though, an aquaponics facility and a private fish pond really aren't the same thing. Aquaponics facilities typically have a lower fish escapement risk, which is one thing we're really concerned about, than private fish ponds, and that's because in most instances they're what we call closed loop, meaning these are indoor facilities, typically receive water from a culinary source, and the water is discharged usually goes into a sewer or a septic system. In contrast, private fish ponds are outdoor ponds that usually have some kind of connectivity to a public waterway. So what the PAC recommended was establishing some criteria where aquaponics facilities can operate without a certificate of registration, and the Division of Wildlife Resources developed some language for doing that that was approved by the PAC. So what we're recommending is adding some language to our private pond rule, which again is R657-59, that establishes criteria for when an aquaponics facility can operate without a COR. So what we're recommending is that no COR is necessary, provided that the aquaponics facility is a hobby operation, regardless of whether it's for personal use, or there's some provisions in this rule change that we're recommending that allow schools for educational purposes to operate aquaponics facilities without a COR. Next off, the facility would have to be closed loop, so that's what I talked about earlier, where they're indoors, receive water from a culinary source, and the discharge goes into a sewer or septic system. Next off, all applicable fish health rules are followed when the fish are imported. The fish cannot leave the facility alive, and the species of fish it's raised is from a Division of Wildlife Resources developed list. So what's on that list are bluegill, hybrid bluegill, specifically the cross between bluegill and green sunfish, red ear sunfish, green sunfish, striped bass, white bass, hybrid striped bass or wiper, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, channel catfish, yellow perch, fathead minnow, black crappie, white crappie, rainbow trout, cutthroat trout, brown trout, brook trout, tiger trout, walleye, and golden shiner. I think that's about 20 or 21 species of fish. The reason we selected those species is these are species that already have naturalized populations here in Utah. So if fish were to escape from an aquaponics facility, it wouldn't lead to the establishment of a new species here in the state. And there's also health certified sources for these fish already here in the state. So this should be pretty easy for an aquaponics facility to attain. Now, on top of those fish species, we also threw in there all other fish species that are listed as non-controlled for possession and importation under a collection, importation, and possession rule, which is R657-3. I don't know how many fish species that covers. They're primarily ornamental species. It's probably hundreds or thousands of fish species included in that kind of that catch-all there at the end of the species list. Now, we passed that list, passed the aquaponics industry here in the state, and they recommended that we add jade perch, sleepy cod, and tiger shrimp to that no COR species list that I presented in the last slide. We had some discussions within the division about that with some of our native fish, our sport fish, our fish health, and our aquatic invasive species people, and we decided not to add those species basically on the basis that there's no escaped wild populations of either or any of those species here in the United States. So if they were to escape a facility, it would lead to the establishment of some of the first populations of those species here in the United States. And based on just environmental conditions these species can tolerate, we think that these are species that could survive here in Utah. Next, these species have been raised in aquaponics facilities in other countries, and they have escaped some of those facilities, and they're considered invasive in those other countries where they're having some impacts on native fishes. And next off, these are species that are known carriers of diseases that threaten both cultured or hatchery fish and wild fish populations. Now, with that said, we didn't add these species to that list of species. It doesn't require a certificate of registration, but as part of this rule change, we're not taking away the certificate of registration process. So there would be an option if somebody wants to raise these species to request a COR for them, and if it's granted, they could have those species in their facility. And as I mentioned earlier, CORs will still be available, and they'll still be granted in instances when the aquaponics facility is not a hobby operation. Now, in that case, that's a COR from the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food. When the facility is not closed loop, when some of the fish health rules cannot be met, when the fish leave the facility alive, and when the species of fish is raised is not from that no COR species list. Now, one thing I just want to point out is there are some species that aquaponics facilities are interested in here in Utah. Tilapia are a good example of this, that are actually prohibited here in Utah, and those require a variance from the Wildlife Board in order to be raised, so we're not taking that provision away in this rule that we're recommending tonight. So I just want to thank you for your time. That's just a broad summary of what we're recommending. I also want to thank the PAC for their input on this recommended rule change and the Utah aquaponics industry for their input on the species list. And again, thank you.
Thank you. I have a question, then I'll turn over to the rest of the rack. On the species list on our presentation didn't match with your species list?
Yeah, so there's a slight error. So we took koi off and added yellow perch. Okay. And yeah, so that what was sent out was incorrect. So what's correct is correct. Up here.
Right. That was my only question. Any other questions from the rack? Public? Any comments from the public? We don't have any comment cards. Any comments from the rack? We'll entertain a motion. Don't everyone speak up at once. So it goes something like, we accept as presented.
I move that we accept the regulation. Aquaponic regulations as presented.
Great. We have a motion. Do we have a second? Okay, we have a second. Any more discussion? Let's vote. All in favor?
Unanimous.
Unanimous. Thank you. Appreciate it. Now?
Clarify that again. I was just wondering if you'd clarify, you know, the impact that we're having where we don't have a quorum one more time for me.
So it will be made clear at the board meeting that we were one short of a quorum, but Braden will still be asked to give the point of view of the RAC on each of the action items. And so, I mean, it will be noted and documented that we didn't have a quorum, but that doesn't mean that the input is ignored.
You know, and I'd point out, too, that we do have a member of the board here which can hear our comments and understand, you know, what we may bring up. All right, the final item, the Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plan. Jace Taylor.
Thank you. So my name is Jace Taylor. I'm the Bighorn Sheep and Mountain Goat Biologist for the Utah Division of Wildlife out of the Salt Lake office. What I'll be presenting today are the Bighorn Sheep Unit Management Plans. The unit management plans are a lot like our statewide management plan. You might remember we took a Bighorn Sheep statewide management plan through last October, November. The unit management plans, what they are, they get more into the specifics of the area, the details that deal with the obstacles, the hurdles of that area, what practices we're taking, specific drainages, that kind of thing. So more specific to the area. Kind of some background on why we're bringing these to you guys right now. Last November, the Wildlife Board approved the statewide management plan, which we presented to you. We're approved through all of the RACs, approved at the Wildlife Board. And when that was approved, there was changes in it that we needed to reflect in the unit management plans so that they are all consistent with the statewide plan. So one thing that's probably important to note is that the unit management plans up to now have never been public documents. They've always been internal DWR documents. So it contained the same information, had these same population objectives, but we used them kind of internally to steer management decisions, transplants, habitat projects, those kind of things. But they've never been public because that was never something that we were required to do under statute. But we feel that it's important now to take them, or not just now, but anytime. We feel it's important to take them out and make them public, to get input from the RACs, from the public, from the board, to help make the plans as strong as possible, to make sure that all the consistencies are aware of what we're trying to do, to be as transparent as possible. And so we're excited for this opportunity to bring them through and to get input from people. And we feel that doing so will help us have the strongest plans going forward. The last thing is that, and you've heard this before for some of the other plans, is that these unit management plans will not be presented to the RACs and the board unless there's a significant change to a boundary, a change to a population objective, or it's a new unit that's being presented. So if there's a new area that we're trying to reintroduce bighorn sheep. Other than that, all the other changes will be approved by the DWR director. There are 19 total bighorn sheep units in the state of Utah. Today, we're going to be presenting 18 of them. The one that we're not is the Mineral Mountains. You may remember that was presented May of 2018. The Mineral Mountains, right? So the Mineral Mountains was presented in May 2018. It was approved by the RACs and the board. Nothing in that plan contradicts anything that's in the statewide plan. So because it was approved then and it's fine, we're not going to take it through now. And so these other 18 units, 11 of them are Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep that we have in the northern half of the state. 7 of them are desert bighorn sheep. The ones that you'd have here in the southern region, we have the Oak Creeks would be your only Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep. And then you have the Pine Valley, Zion, and Kaparowitz. The unit management plans, like I mentioned earlier, get into the specifics of the area, but they do reflect overall the statewide plan, the statewide goals, some of our overarching goals. And so those parts that are in these plans are probably worth noting, and so I'll go over those just real quick, or a few of them. These things that we feel important. The DWR's objective is to expand bighorn sheep populations where feasible to maintain bighorn sheep on a sustainable statewide basis. Another important facet is that the DWR will not manage bighorn sheep to the involuntary exclusion of domestic sheep. Maybe a little more specific about that. The DWR recognizes that there is risk inherent with managing bighorn sheep, and we accept that risk, but we are still interested in expanding bighorn sheep when feasible. And then also the DWR's goal is to manage for healthy populations of bighorn sheep that provide quality opportunities for hunting and viewing. Getting into some of the specifics about each plan, they all have a population objective, the number of bighorn sheep that we are striving to manage for, that we want to have in that area. Something that's probably worth noting about these management objectives, population objectives, is that they can change with time as the area, the conditions of that that mountain range change, whether that's development, human development, fires, or play important roles in providing habitat for bighorn sheep, so a new fire could play a change in the population objective. Water availability, we're talking about drinking water, guzzlers, stream improvements, and then also risk of pathogen transmission, which is something that we'll get into a little more in a minute. Overall, with these 18, and then including the Mineral Mountains, the 19 plans, the statewide population objective is 9,025, and the current population estimate is 4,150. This is what that looks like graphically. So the red line at the top, just over 9,000, what we're striving for, and then the blue line over the last 20 or so years since 1996. So the thing that's obvious is that we are less than half of what our objective is. These objectives, you know, admittedly might be a little bit lofty goals, but it's things that we feel are important to strive for. But some good news is that you can see since 96, we've effectively doubled the number of bighorn sheep that we have in the state and been overall fairly successful and continue to increase that. And we hope to, that's something that we continue to do. What it looks like for each unit on this table here lays out the first column is the unit, the second column is the population objective, and the third column is our current best estimate of abundance. So as you look through here, there's a few things that are probably worth talking about. The first one is that you see the number 125 on a number of these, like Antelope Island, Nebo, Pilot Mountain. A lot of these places that have a limited amount of habitat where we don't have any plans to have a lot of bighorn. We just want to have the minimum population that we feel is viable. 125 is the number that we use for that minimum population, minimal viable population. We feel that's important that we have at least that many animals to provide enough animals that hopefully we don't end up with genetic inbreeding and those kind of things. So 125 is almost always the minimum. You'll also see a lot of these are, you might know that a lot of these are broken up into subunits, and those subunits are herds that we feel are fairly independent of each other, at least can be managed independently. So sometimes 125 build up across a number of those builds that number up. A lot of them you see are less than half. We have goals to increase those populations. Those populations don't always mean that we plan to increase the size or the distribution of the herd. A lot of these places, we want the bighorns to be where they are currently. We just want higher density of them in that spot, if that makes sense. So there's that list for you there. Another one of the specific things that you read in through the management plans is how we plan to address respiratory disease. Respiratory disease is the most common limiting factor for these populations that are not able to reach their population objective. Bighorn sheep struggle with pneumonia that they contract from pathogens that are carried by other animals. And so to address respiratory disease, we lay out in the plans how we want to strive for spatial and temporal and or temporal separation. And that separation is from animals that we feel are likely to be carrying the pathogens. Definitely other bighorn herds that struggle with respiratory disease, which is most of our bighorn herds, but then also the other animal that we feel is the most common carrier of these pathogens are domestic sheep and goats, and that's based on the current science. We also feel that it's important to employ emerging technologies to treat bighorn herds that struggle with respiratory disease and then also to avoid them from picking up those pathogens. We also are supportive of voluntary win-win agreements with individual livestock operators that help promote separation from bighorn sheep and other animals that we are concerned about. We also think it's important that we remove bighorn sheep that we feel pose a threat to the greater herd, so it's something that we undertake common, and then also stray domestic animals that we fear pose a threat as well. We also work hard to manage the density, the sex ratio, the age structure of the herds so that we feel that in ways that reduce wandering events. Wandering events of bighorns that leave the herd and then come back are a serious concern to us, and that's something that we are striving to minimize that as much as possible. And then also with respiratory disease, we sample all of our herds on a kind of a rotational basis. We get through them, try to get through each of them every 5 years so that we can understand what we have in each herd. The habitat objectives are laid out in each plan, getting into the specific drainages or areas where we can do improvements. We're always trying to maintain or improve bighorn sheep habitat to enhance individual herd success. So water projects, fires that could improve habitat, and then also the spatial and or temporal separation. Another thing that's laid out in the plans is our recreation objectives, which are to increase public awareness and education while working to expand opportunities to view bighorn sheep, as well as to increase hunting opportunities as the populations allow, while maintaining quality hunting experiences. One of the big changes is that in the statewide plan, we increased the number of permits that the DWR is able to recommend for these units. Now we can recommend 12 to 25% of the counted rams, or 30 to 60% of the counted rams that are 6 years old or older. Those counts are from our helicopter or ground surveys that are done every 1 to 3 years. And then one thing that's probably important to mention with that is that with that change, we are arguably now arguably the most aggressive state when it comes to hunting rams. And a lot of that's calculated. We feel that that's an important thing that will hopefully reduce the chance that rams will wander from the herd. Those are the animals that most tend to wander, and it's often when we have high densities or high or older age structures of rams, we feel that it increases the opportunity or the incentive for those rams to leave the herd. And then also, we feel it's important to explore hunts with variable season lengths, dates, and weapon types, and then also explore female-only hunts when needed to address density and population concerns. For our populations that are coming close to objective, we feel it's important that we manage the herd size by including some of these EU hunts. And that's everything that I have. I appreciate your time, and I'd look forward to getting input.
Great, thank you. We'll start with questions from the RAC.
Jace, could you elaborate a little bit on, for my education, this use of spatial and temporal separation?
Yeah, sure. So, as I mentioned, almost all of the bighorn sheep herds that we have right now struggle with respiratory disease, meaning that they have the pathogens that cause respiratory disease that we're most concerned about. It's important for us that we don't get herd mixture. The pathogens in different combinations being mixed between the herds could definitely increase the risk of respiratory disease. And the same thing goes with domestic sheep and goats that we fear carry these pathogens. We try to keep them temporally, so in time, and then spatially in space, separated from each other. So if we know that there's an area where there's an allotment that has domestic sheep on it that we're concerned about, we try to do everything we can to keep bighorn from getting to that area. And then same with the bighorn herds. Anything we can do to keep, space between bighorns that carry these pathogens, we strive for to help reduce the mixing of the pathogens.
So how do you get them separated by space? What do you do?
Yeah, so hunts, for example. So we could separate, we have a boundary, say, for example, for like a Zion unit, for example, that we have down here. And we know that there are, the Caparowitz herd, going to the east. So we have a buffer in between the two where if we have bighorns that go into that space, we go and we lethally remove them to try to keep animals from moving across that area. We do that with, collared animals that we know go into there, as well as reports we get from people in the area, as well as our biologists going in there and checking those areas. That's an example. Same idea with an allotment. If we know there's allotment, on, say, the Gilsons, the north end of the Oak Creeks, and there's bighorns on the Oak Creeks, and as they get further north, we do things that, whether it's hazing or whether it's, hunts, and do things to try to keep them, from getting too far north into those areas.
So I guess the same type of strategy is used on the wandering events. You're trying to get the big rams.
Sorry, repeat that one time.
You mentioned down here how to deal with wandering events.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so
that's to remove the big rams.
Yeah, so another strategy. Great question. Yeah, so where are you going with that? So we think that when you have older age structures, the more old rams you have in a population, the more often they're going to win the breeding opportunities. And so the younger rams, it's harder for them to get those opportunities. And so we feel that by having a lot of old rams, that the younger rams have more incentive to leave because they can't get breeding opportunities in the herd, and so they start leaving. So yeah, a hunting strategy, this permit percentage recommendations where we can give more permits. We hope that's going to kind of lower the age structure in some of these areas that we have the higher concerns. And then also, just the lower densities, lower age structure. I see what you're doing. Yeah, that's a good question.
Thank you.
Yep.
Jace, I have a question. As far as the statewide plan, the 12 to 25% of rams or 30 to 60% of class 3 or 4, mm-hmm. How do you choose on a unit plan the or there, which way you're going to go?
Yeah, sure. So that's up to the discretion of the biologist. And it can do, kind of coming back to Nick's question, if a unit we have more concern about wandering or commingling, contact with other animals, then the biologist, is aware of that. They know that. And they oftentimes can offer more permits. It's the discretion of the biologist. And, they take input from, these racks and, communicating with hunters as well as understanding, you know, some of those risks of pathogen transmission, it's their call.
So that would be at the time of permit recommendations after the surveys when they would decide that. It's not fair to say that a unit is already predetermined which way they're going to go.
No, I mean, I think that if you ask the biologists, I think they have a sense of what they want, you know, in the unit all the time. I think that they keep tabs on that all the time. But yeah, the actual recommendation happens, you know, in our spring rack when the permit recommendations come to you guys and you guys can, you know, vote on that.
Thank you.
Other questions, Gene?
Is there any danger with trying to double ram our sheep populations that they're going to expand range and therefore be more likely to interact and then get the disease in and then crash?
Yeah,
good question. And lose the whole doggone deal?
That's a good question, yeah. So I think it's important that some of these places, we are trying to increase the herd number, but we're not necessarily trying to expand their distribution. We don't want them to use any more space than what they're using right now. And that's something that we'll definitely be monitoring as these populations grow. We'll always be aware of how they're growing and trying to keep them from interacting more. But yeah, I mean, you can make the same argument about if we didn't have any sheep in the state, then we wouldn't have any risks, right? But I think that we're trying always to balance that number with the level of risk and the number of animals that we're trying to have in the state. I think that's something that we are always aware of, and we recognize that if a population does increase in distribution or density, that we are increasing the risk, and we'll do our very best to balance that.
When do you expect to reach this population objective?
That's a good question, Gene. So I will admit that the population objective in a lot of places is may never happen. It's always our goal to reach those objectives. For example, say the Nebo, we've had bighorns there for a number of years. We've always been trying to have 125. We have 50 there right now. That's the biggest it's ever been. Do I think we'll ever get to 125? It's hard to say. It's probably unlikely, but we'll always be striving for it. It'd be hard for me to say when we're actually going to reach that 9,000 number. I don't think that we'll ever probably get there with the current herds that we have. It might take time with expansion of new herds and those kind of things.
Okay, well, these high objectives, will they determine policy on things such as number of tags and so forth? That, in other words, that if a herd is not at the objective, which most of them won't be for a long time, will that be used as a reason to cut tags or keep tags down?
It's a good question, Gene. So the ram permits, no. We won't be reducing ram permits because we're not at objective. But we are very unlikely to offer a ewe hunt in a unit that is not, you know, is nowhere near the population objective. So of the units, you know, you look at this table here, very few of them are near population objective. So the one that is the closest is the Newfoundland Mountains. So 310, that's a population objective from early this year. We're striving for 350. That's a situation where we are, you know, considering would be likely to have a female-only hunt sometime down the road. And so the population objective, I hope this is answering your question. If we are not near the population objective, we are not likely to give a female-only hunt, but it's hopefully not going to be influencing the ram opportunity to hunt rams. Go ahead, Kevin.
Can I add just a little bit of that to Jason? Correct me if I'm wrong. The other thing that could happen with these, Gene, is like you take the Elk Creeks. We've set the population objective at 300. That's kind of our best guess of what we think that mountain range can hold. If we got to 220 and we had a lot of wandering, and we were, you know, we weren't having good lamb recruitment. We were getting indications that that's probably the limit. We may reduce that objective down to 200, and at that point have some ewe hunts. So these are aspirational. We may get there. We may not. We may have to reduce the objective to have a healthy herd, and we'll let the sheep tell us what that right number is if we don't have it right.
Yep. Thanks, Kevin.
I have a question on the slide on the respiratory disease. You don't need to go to that slide, but my question is, you have several bullets there of how you're hoping to address it, and the concern that I see, and it might just be my perceived concern, is just an educational problem. For example, llamas and pack goats seem to be becoming more and more popular, and I wonder how many of those owners have any idea that those animals are potential hazards. You know, we talked that we had one up on the Oak Creeks this week. Are we doing any, are we addressing an educational program to help people understand the impacts that their pack animals may have?
That's a great question. So I think maybe even bigger than the pack animals, education-wise, I think that we are doing things to try to, you know, get the word out that there are risks to bighorn with respiratory disease. You know, we've had some open house meetings in some of the communities around, like Zion, for example, trying to, you know, talk to folks that have animals and make them aware of those kind of things. But specifically about pack animals, you're right. So pack goats, pack llamas are becoming more popular for hunting or even just, you know, recreating, packing in, backpacking, those kind of things, using them as a pack animal, much like someone would a horse, right? So definitely becoming more popular. We do not have any, I can't say that we've done anything, a large-scale education project yet. We have worked with individuals that have come to us and talked to us a little bit. And right now, our kind of plan is to work with land management agencies, so the BLM and the Forest Service. We've started those conversations as far as, you know, what can we do as far as trail restrictions or things along those lines. And I think what we decide we want to do together, you know, collaboratively with those land management agencies will dictate, you know, the path that we take for education. But yeah, I think that I appreciate you bringing it up. It's definitely something that is important that we know is important, that we hope to be able to make some strides with working with as it becomes more popular.
So let me just clarify, as I understand it, and I think you did add some good clarity. I think in general, the sheep ranchers are very aware.
Yeah.
You know, and they have allotted areas, and we know their allotments, but I think it really is the recreational use that is uneducated. Yeah. Is there anything in, and I believe that, I think you answered this, but let me just ask again, is there anything in the plan, you know, under this respiratory disease portion of the plan to address that? And could we put it in there?
That's a good question. For the statewide plan, as far as pack animals go, if we do talk about it, it's briefly. You know, I don't think that there's anything in depth that talks about any efforts or any plans to move forward with that. I know that there are some of these unit management plans. I can think, for example, up there's the San Rafael, some of the San Rafael swell stuff. The biologist there is one of those that's kind of on the forefront of working with the BLM and having trail restrictions and things like that. I know that in his unit plan, for example, that there are some specifics about it. By and large, I would say no, there's not a lot of specific language about the need to work with those groups.
Would you have any concern about adding language like
no,
that into the plan?
Idea.
You wouldn't have any concern?
Idea.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Jace, one question. Under the possible hunting opportunities, do we have any provision in the statewide or in a unit plan to offer juvenile ram hunts? Has that been considered or discussed? If they are the wandering sheep, I'm curious if we have a provision to offer those kind of permits.
No. Yeah. like a half curl or less kind of a thing,
it is common in some other states where they offer juvenile to curb populations. I assume the wandering or inability to breed is what they're trying to target.
Yeah, I do know a couple places that have tried things. I think it'd be difficult, but like you say, other places have done it. It's not something that we have that we've discussed and as a, you know, as a group or anything that we've pursued. I think that kind of the tactic that we're kind of trying after right now is by increasing, you know, RAM permits in general. We assume that probably be more of the older RAMs that are taken, and that hopefully by lowering the entire age structure that we can hopefully get at the same goal. It's not a bad idea. It's nothing that we've discussed very much.
Okay, thanks.
Not a bad idea, though.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Let's deal with the pneumonia deal. You said that it's kind of present there all the time. I mean, in some form in the group or, you know, in the herds.
So not necessarily, no. Most of the herds have started at one point without the pathogens that are causing respiratory disease, but then over time, a number of them started without it and then picked it up over time. Some of our herds here in the state have had it, you know, for a long, long time and probably were even started with it before we understood it completely.
So they've got it. So they developed immunity to it, so it doesn't affect them. Is that?
I see where you're going. Yeah. So the herds that have had the pathogens in them for a long, long time that have persisted, and some of them that are even growing, for example, that's kind of the question. Why are those herds doing well? What's happened in those herds to allow them to continue to exist and even grow? And the answer is this. Yeah. There are different pathogens. It's a whole combination of pathogens that a herd can get that can cause this respiratory disease. It's not just any one thing. And even within those different pathogens, there's different varieties or strains of the pathogen that are more or less aggressive, that are harder on the animals, right? And so sometimes you get a herd that, we'll take Zion, for example. This is what we feel is the case with Zion. Did not have respiratory disease, did not have the pathogen that we're most concerned about. But here this last July of 2018, is that right? So July 18, started seeing coughing animals, went and did some more testing, had picked up the pathogen in, you know, a few months, that, you know, since the last time we tested them, which is pretty recent. And so they picked up the pathogen, we're really concerned, coughing animals, but nothing's died from it. And the population seems to be doing, you know, fairly well overall, continuing to do fine. So we feel that in that situation, the pathogen in the herd is a less aggressive, less deadly pathogen. Could also be, you know, that's what we feel, could also be, like you're saying, maybe those animals are more genetically resistant to the pathogen. Could be that. But it's, you know, we see this wide, you know, spectrum of response. Some herds just crash from it. Some seem to do just fine. We think that it has to do with that health, the health of the herd, and the virulence of the pathogen.
Yeah, you had no violent one that wiped.
Yeah, they really struggled. Yeah. Yeah, we've had some. We even had a worse one. Was the Stansberry's back in like 2015, 16, like 90% of those things died from it. Wish we had the answer. That's what we feel is our best answer right now.
Any other questions from the room? Go ahead, Gene.
On the Antelope Island herd, is there any possibility that they contacted a pathogen without ever contacting any domestic animal?
Yeah, sure. So there's definitely possible. So we do not know exactly how the Antelope Island bighorn herd picked up the pathogen that started causing respiratory disease. We do know we tested them quite a bit prior to last November. Last November is about when we started seeing sick animals and dying animals. Prior to that, we tested quite a few of them because we'd moved so many off, and they did not have the certain pathogen that we were worried about. Once they started getting sick, we tested some and did find that pathogen in them. So somehow the pathogen got into the herd. We know that much. And then the pathogen that we're talking about, as we currently understand from the current science, is that it needs to come in contact with another animal that's carrying the pathogen, either physical contact or very close enough to that they could cough on each other, that kind of thing. So somehow or other, a bighorn on Antelope Island came, into close contact with another animal that was carrying the pathogen. What that animal was, whether it was wild or domestic, we can't say for sure. So we do not know the answer to that. We feel, based on the science that we have, that's most likely that it came in contact with another animal that was carrying the pathogen.
What other wild animals besides sheep carry the pathogen?
So, and this is an interesting thing. If you'd asked me that question a year ago, I'd have said that the only other wild animals that carry the pathogen are wild mountain goats, right? Sheep and goats, wild sheep, wild goats. Recently, there are some studies coming out that suggest that there are other animals wild animals that may be able to carry the pathogen. A lot of that hasn't been cross-validated. We are interested in it enough that we are testing other animals, and so hopefully we can help the science, the broad-based science, to understand that better. There is, as far as cross-validation goes, in Alaska, they feel fairly confident that caribou can carry it, and that, which is a new thing. You know, a year ago, I don't think anybody would have really thought that, and so, we are testing other animals and continuing to learn, but nothing's solid enough that I'd be willing to say other animals.
Would stress or from either hunting or weather cause the pathogen to come up?
Yeah, I don't think it would cause the pathogen to arise. Like I said, we tested a lot of animals prior to the disease event. But yes, if it's in a herd and the herd could be doing just fine, even with the pathogen and a stress event, you know, real harsh winter, or real dry summer, or too high of a density, or whatever it could be, something real stressful could cause it to flare up and become, to escalate into actual respiratory disease. Yeah, that's a good question. But with the case of Anopind, I don't think it was there beforehand.
Hey, Jace, on Antelope Island, is there an intended supply herd for the transplant of Rockies the plan?
Yeah. I think in the plan it doesn't say super specific, but it does mention Montana and New Mexico, I think. We have a couple herds, a herd from each state that as of right now, we have potential to bring them out there to Antelope Island, hopefully in January 2020, if everything goes well.
So, and if we could consider California as a separate species, they would be totally gone. We're talking Rockies for those that consider
Species. So what Austin's asking about is this idea of a subspecies of Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep that people oftentimes call California bighorn sheep, which is what we had on Antelope Island previously, which is what we have on the Newfoundland Mountains, Stansbury Mountains, and the Oak Creek Mountains. No, the new animals that we're looking at getting, they're not considered California. They're just considered general Rocky.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions from the RAC? Questions from the public?
I had a couple, but you and Kevin covered it.
If you would just state your name and then questions, we'll do comments in just a minute.
Okay. Scott Stubbs. So on that
Scott, is that mic on?
Sounds scary now. Scott Stubbs. So, Jace, Antelope Island, it seems like it would have been a perfect time. Did we test all the other wildlife on Antelope Island?
It's a good question. So we did not test them at the time. We have plans to test them before we bring out bighorn sheep. So we have early November. We'll test bison, pronghorn, and deer is what we plan to test.
So with that, I mean, I don't know about Antelope Island, but it seems like it's probably not real mountainous. Maybe it is real mountainous.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a mountain spine that runs north to south, but it's not. I mean, the elevation will go from, I guess, whatever the lake is. The lake's 42, and it goes up to like 6, so a couple thousand feet at most.
So with that, I mean, with like domestic sheep and cows, they get right in each other's face. So I'm questioning. I think it's good that we're testing everything because like a buffalo or a deer or whatever, they're more apt to come in contact on fairly the same elevation than they would be, say, where you got the sheep up in the top of mountains and the cows down more in the valley. So I think this is an important opportunity for that. Hasn't it been shown that bighorns carry the pathogen then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Bighorn sheep and carry the pathogen, wild bighorn sheep, and most of the herds in the state, like of that 41, 50 that we have in the state, all but probably... maybe 600 of them. So 3,500 of those are in herds where the pathogen is present. Doesn't mean that every single animal in the herd carries it, but they're part of a herd where we have found it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the public? Okay, we'll do comments from the public. I only have two comment cards, which would be 100% of the public. So we'll start with Bryce Pilling and then Scott Stubbs.
Bryce Pilling, thanks to Braden. I'd just like to say that we support the recommendations that have been given by the division, and I'm representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife and also our Utah Wild Sheep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Stubbs. I'm here for representing me, but also the wool growers, and I'd like to say we support your recommendation. The one thing I would like to bring up, and I'm hoping that maybe there could even be a motion about, is in the Antelope Island Management Plan, it goes right into blaming domestic sheep. And with it says that you don't know where the contamination came from, and then it says, but it's suspected sheep. And the last year and a half that I've been involved in this process, I've seen a great thing happen, in my opinion. I think that livestock people and hunters have really come together on all sorts of issues, and we're doing great things. But it's kind of hard to be blamed for things that aren't proven. Like this goat, if that turns out to put pneumonia in those sheep, it needs to be said that goat did it. It did. But it doesn't need to be domestic sheep, because that throws it on the wool grower. So I think we got to be a little careful with pointing fingers. But I do think that we're going down a good road. This is a good way to... We're going to have to figure out, and I'm willing, whatever I can do with my sheep to help. If there's some way I can treat my sheep so they can't contaminate, or we can do anything to make them more resistant, we need to. I understand that this is the neatest thing you could ever hunt, and people want more of it. So we've got to keep working together. We don't want to get pointing fingers. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now have comments from the RAC. I'd like to start on this one if I could. Actually, first, let me just make sure. All the RAC members, I received several emails, and I believe they were copied to all the RAC, so hopefully you had the chance to read those. We'll trust that you read those. Scott, I'd love to comment to your comment, and I actually would probably maybe even like to hear your response, if that's all right. That's a little out of process, but I've been very involved in this I got involved in this when we started talking about putting sheep on the minerals, and I've been involved in a lot of conversations and been in a lot of meetings, and to see the progress we've made on this from some of the original meetings where it was extremely confrontational to where we've ended and really working together quite well. And I think what you said is absolutely true, that we've taken a lot of the confrontation out of this, and we've seen a lot of headway made between sportsmen and cattlemen and wool growers, and I think it's a really good thing. Here would be my comment / question. I think, because some of the emails address the same thing on Antelope Island, and as I thought about that, it kind of goes back to the other question I had on the education of the respiratory disease. I guess as I read that, and I probably read it with a different set of eyes, I don't look at it as pointing fingers at the wool growers. We've said all along that if bighorns get into a herd of sheep, that we're going to go kill the bighorn. It's not the sheep's fault. It's a bighorn's fault. And so I don't see it necessarily as pointing fingers at the sheep, but what I do think it does is I think it's a high enough visibility and profile that it helps educate the public that they are sensitive. And so I guess maybe it's just a different viewpoint. I don't look at it as blaming the sheep. I look at it as more of an educational. These sheep are very susceptible to domestics. And so I would be hesitant to get too far away from that. I don't see it as blaming, I guess, is what I'm saying. So that'd be my comment.
Well, I'd respond to that by saying all sorts of wildlife are known to carry this. So why didn't we name all sorts of them? I mean, in my opinion, it'd be fair to me to put right below that on the Zion unit. It seems to be flourishing, running right next to domestic sheep. The reason they're doing so well is there's no hunting. I mean, you know, that's not right, but that's the same speculation. I understand education's key, but I don't think you're educating anybody there, and I think you've got something put in there. Somebody will twist down the road. Not one from our side, by the way, but somebody will twist that. Well, see, the sheep did this. That's just the way I read it.
You know, and maybe there's some fairness there. Maybe we could word that. If we approached it from an educational wording, maybe we could word it somehow so it helped people understand that we believe the die-off there was caused by getting this disease, and here's what causes the disease, and just be factual. I don't know. Other comments from the RAC? Go ahead, Craig.
My only comment is, and I talked to Jace about this earlier in the week, objective numbers, I've counted them, there's four out of all those 18 units or so that are even close, anywhere close to objective, none of them are there. I think that objective lines, numbers need to be lowered, more realistic numbers, because of the pneumonia problem in them. I don't think there's any way we'll ever be able to achieve those kind of numbers. So that's my comment.
Austin, go ahead.
I'd like to share my comment. I was able to read comments that came from the public and from interested parties to myself and to the other members of the RAC. And I understand these management plans, in particular the Antelope Island Management Plan, to be, as it was previously used, as an internal document by the division. And the portion which states that their infection on Antelope Island, is the cause was unknown, falls under the issues and concerns portion of that, which I feel is a proper place for that to fall in the management plan. It does not fall under the history as a document of exactly what happened, but it falls under the issues and concerns because I do feel that bighorn sheep in Utah, we are essentially writing the book. It is a very tough species. It's very misunderstood, and there's a lot we can learn. And Antelope Island especially is an opportunity for Utah to test and to try and to learn. And so I feel those comments in the document, in the unit plan, are properly fit where they are at, issues and concern, not as a blame game or a history or a chronological event list, but simply this is what we know at the current time. That would be my comment.
Thank you. Other comments from the RAC? Go ahead, Gene.
And first of all, the bighorn sheep are a high maintenance asset. It takes a lot more maintenance on the sheep than it does for mule deer or for elk. I think fortunately there are groups that put money into it. And that helps a lot. And I can see that you've got a real problem with that. I mean, it's a big job to manage your sheep and goats in Utah. But I think that I'm a little concerned about these management objective numbers.
that it's going to get in the way of some of the management, because with the other species, we sometimes suggest an increase, and it's like the herd objective is cast in concrete, it's chiseled in stone, and we can't give you any more tag because we're not at objective. And I'm afraid that might come up with these lofty objectives. It's a little concerning to me. Thank you.
Any other comments from the RAC? I'm hesitant to make this comment, but I do want to make one more comment. I think the objectives, for me, the objectives get muddy and confusing. And let me share my opinion, which may be wrong. But let me throw the example of elk and buffalo. We have objective on those, which are ceilings. And we're constantly chasing that objective, and we shoot a lot of animals trying to achieve that objective, and it's used as a way of managing herd size. And then we have another objective on deer, which roughly 20 years ago we lowered that because we were using it as a goal, not a ceiling. And so we're using the same term inconsistently. And it causes some confusion, as we've heard tonight on these sheep. Is this objective a ceiling or is it a goal? If it's a goal, it's managed differently than if it's a ceiling. So I have some concerns on the way we use objective. I would love, I've brought this up for years, actually, in our November meeting discussing big game. I don't understand why we do the objective the way we do it on deer. I think it should be a ceiling, and then it would be very easy to understand it. But I think it does cause confusion, as we saw tonight. Any other comments? If not, we'd entertain a motion. Before the motion, I'm not allowed to make a motion, but I would... If whoever makes a motion may entertain that idea of adding something in the plan about education. As we heard from the biologists, he had no concerns with that. Yeah, thank you.
All right, so really just two categories of comments. The one from the wool growers. Just the request to have the language in the Antelope Island plan changed so that it doesn't specifically identify domestic sheep when there wasn't a specific incident that can be pointed to that involved domestic sheep. Is that a fair summary of that, Scott? And then from the RAC, a need to reduce population objectives to more reasonable numbers given the current population sizes are kind of the two categories of comments that we heard.
Thanks, Kevin. We'd entertain a motion if anyone's ready.
Try it with some help. Help me out here. I propose that we accept the management plan as presented, other than to help the full wool growers. I'd like to include in that we drop in that Antelope Island deal the blame of domestic sheep causing the problem there, and then however you'd like to put I'll use some help on the education part of it.
I would suggest just fairly simple, add to the plan an educational approach to the respiratory disease.
Okay. and I'm good with that.
And to add language to the statewide plan addressing
education on that respiratory.
Education on the risks of respiratory disease beyond just
Okay, so here's how I've captured that.
Is your mic on, Kevin? To accept the management plan as presented, but change the language in the antelope island plan to more accurately portray what we know. And to add language to the statewide plan addressing education regarding respiratory disease to expand those efforts beyond just sheep producers. And I have a whole bunch of misspellings in there, but that's what we've got. And I've put in parentheses pack animals, backyard herds, etc. Does that capture what we were going for?
Sounds good.
Okay, so we have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second.
We have a second by Sean. Any further discussion? All right, let's take a vote. All in favor? Any opposed?
One.
4-1. And then this is new, but in this.
Hold on. Your number. Gotcha.
What's that?
The numbers weren't adding up, but you're number 6 and you didn't vote. So yeah. I was wondering why we didn't have 6, but I figured it out. Sorry.
So in the new information I got, it's suggesting that if we have someone opposed, that they're given the opportunity to state why they're opposed. So, Austin, if you want to, you'd have that opportunity, just for the record.
Yeah, just for the record, just how I read that section about removing that verbiage, I didn't think that that was warranted in the Antelope Island plan specifically. And that's the only reason that I oppose that motion.
Okay, thank you. I really like that idea of being able to state why you're opposed, because I think it adds a lot of clarity. I think it's a good change, so I will attempt to always do that going forward, but you're not required if you don't want to. So, okay, I think that covers that. The last item is other business, and I'll give it back to Kevin.
Okay. I think those of you that attended the RAC and Board training were introduced to the idea of an effort that we're trying to develop a process to gather input from a broader audience using some sort of online commenting system. Wow, that mic is sensitive. Can you turn that down a little bit? And I think this...
Give this one back to Tammy.
I don't know if it's this part of the table, because we've had two different mics sitting right... You know, I don't know if it's... No, I can hear it now.
You can hear it buzzing?
No, but I can hear myself now.
Anyway, now that I let me get my train of thought back. Now that Phil's totally messed me up here. So anyway, we're undergoing or trying to in the process of developing a process to gather input online to reach a broader audience with the recommendations that come through the regional advisory council and go to the wildlife board. The current process, and this will evolve over time, is going to be that the presentations as they are presented to the RACs will be videotaped and put online approximately a week prior to the first RAC meeting. First RAC meeting is normally the northern region, and it's on a Tuesday. Those will be taken down on Sunday, the Sunday prior to the RAC meeting on Tuesday, and those comments that are gathered online will be summarized and sent out to the RACs and to the regional supervisors. And so at the end of each action item, after either before or after we gather public input and RAC input, there'll be a summary of what the online comments were. And you will all of the RAC members will have an opportunity to see those beforehand as well, and then they'll be summarized. Some of it will be quantitative in terms of, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5, how much do you agree or disagree with this? And so we'll be able to put some quantification to it. And then as RACs, we're going to have to struggle and figure out how we're going to incorporate that input into the votes that are made and weigh those comments with the comments that we receive in person here at the RAC meetings. Again, I think this is going to be a learning process and a process that evolves over time, but that's how we're going to start. And then at the board meeting, the comments that are gathered through that online process will be presented to the Wildlife Board essentially like a sixth RAC meeting. So each of the RAC chairs or there'll be a summary of each of the RAC meetings, and at the Wildlife Board meeting, each of the RAC chairs will have an opportunity to talk to the board about how or what the sentiment was within each individual RAC member, and then there'll also be a sixth summary of that online comment period. So again, I think we will hit that in full force at the November RAC. That'll all be in place, and you should expect to get some emails or a packet of emails, a summary of all those emails. For us, it'll be about a week prior to our RAC meeting. For the Central Region, it's going to be a day prior to their RAC meeting, so they're going to have not a lot of time to be able to digest all of that. So anyway, that's a process that's coming. I think it's a very positive process to get a broader segment of the public included in this public process, but it is something that we're going to have to adjust and evolve with and figure out as we go forward. So with that being said, any comments or questions you'd like me to report back just on the idea?
I really like the idea. I like that process. My comment back would be, I think in order to make this process as smooth as it can be, because I don't want to get caught in reading Facebook comments. Yeah. I think what I would like to ask is that the RAC members take that upon themselves to read the comments beforehand. We can acknowledge, you know, something that everyone's got those, that you've seen those. But I would hate to get caught up in trying to regurgitate those.
Yeah, I don't think we will be spend time reading each individual comment. Somehow they will be summarized in some sort of a succinct manner. The more that we can quantify that, the better, so that we know what it means. I mean, is there a level of support or non-support on a given issue? So.
All right, anything else we need to discuss?
Just thank the public for attending tonight.
Yeah. Oh, he's still here. Thank you, public, for attending tonight. Okay, meeting's adjourned.